I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and it is a beautiful day. It's July 30th, 2013, and I'm feeling really good. How about you? I just got a beautiful gift that I wasn't expecting. It's not even my birthday. It's just a beautiful day. And Gary Noel just gave me a copy of his new cookbook, Anti-Arthritis, Anti-Inflammation Cookbook, Healing Through Natural Foods, over 270 delicious vegan, vegetarian, and raw food recipes. And it's gorgeous. It's stunning. And what one thing that I really love about cookbooks, the ones that I really love, I'm going to say, are the ones that are filled with beautiful pictures. I think every recipe has a picture. It's really stunning. And one thing he pointed out to me, which I want to point out to you, is that this book is printed on recycled paper with vegetable-based inks, and they are planting more trees than were required to print this publication. So very exciting, gorgeous book. It's heavy, and now I have to bring it home, but I'm not complaining. Okay, and the other thing I wanted to mention, I mentioned this last week, and now I'm really mentioning it because the Swingin' Gourmets, my vegan musical cabaret act, now has its first food show. It's sort of a food show documentary video. It is live online. Please go to swinginggourmets.com and watch it. It's 28 minutes, so this is like television. This isn't one of these quick soundbite things. This is sit back, relax, sip your green juice, and watch. It's fun. And then when you've finished your assignment, let me know what you think. Okay? info@realmeals.org. That's where you find me. Very good. You got that? I'll remind you later because it's really important that you watch this. All right, now, moving on to my first guest who is joining me here in the studio. Ellen Zakos leads foraging walks and currently teaches at the New York Botanical Garden, where she received her certification in commercial horticulture and ethnobotany. She writes two blogs, which can be found at downanddirtygardening.com and Garden Bites, and that's with a Y-B-Y-T-E. GardenBites.com, and has written numerous gardening books and contributed to publications including Horticulture and Better Homes and Gardens. And I'm looking at her beautiful new book, which I got when I was at the Book Expo several months ago here in New York at the Javits Center, Backyard Foraging, 65 Familiar Plants You Didn't Know You Could Eat. Okay, welcome to It's All About Food, Ellen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this is a really beautiful book. And just like I was saying about Gary Noel's cookbook, this is also filled with beautiful pictures good enough to eat. Mm-hmm. Kind of makes me want to lick the pages.
I hope it makes you want to go out and forage for the foods and then lick them.
Right. Well, the thing that I think is so important is I think we've lost a lot of our either instinctual knowledge or ancestral knowledge or some kind of knowledge that used to be useful to us, and that was what we could go outside and find to eat, foraging. You know, we talk about humans being hunter-gatherers. Well, I believe we were foragers before we were hunter-gatherers.
Well, I think foraging is gathering. I mean, I think it's the same thing. I think it's they're synonyms for each other, and I absolutely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, today, not only do most people not know where their kitchen is, and they don't know how to make food, and they barely know how to buy it, and they don't know most of the vegetables and fruits that are in the produce section, they certainly don't know what's out there growing wild.
Yeah.
That's edible.
Yeah. And, you know, just a few generations ago, that was not the case.
How fast it happened.
And I was talking, I was hiking with some friends that over the weekend, and some foraging friends, and we were talking about, I don't know why we were talking about this, but we were talking about how growing up we were all fed from cans.
Right.
And, you know, I love my parents, and my mom is a good cook, but they thought it was perfectly acceptable to open a can of wax beans and serve that to us for dinner.
Spinach.
They were
spinach.
Awful. Yeah. But it was, I think, a sign of prosperity or something. You know, my grandparents were immigrants from Greece, and the fact that and I know my grandmother knew how to forage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how they fed themselves. But then, you know, the next generation was here and they didn't have to do that. And it was like, yeah, we can just buy cans of food. We have arrived.
Yeah, well, and there was a novelty to it, too.
Yeah. And it was, I think, not a step in the right direction.
No, definitely not. So I don't know if we'll ever get back, but one of the things I loved about this book is there are just so many foods out there we don't even know about them.
Yeah.
Our selection of foods has been so filtered down into just a handful based on whatever Big Ag wants to grow.
Yeah, what they can sell, what they can ship, what they can grow least expensively.
Yeah.
That's what we're
fed. Which is really unfortunate. Yeah. So let's just jump in. Okay, we're gonna jump in and get to know some of these wonderful foods for a minute. Even before we do, you put some warnings or disclaimers or things we need to know about.
I really just wanted to say at the beginning, don't be stupid.
Don't be stupid.
And if you are, don't blame me. But of course, you can't say that. You know, you can be a little more polite.
Well, the things that we don't want to do is we don't want to grab things that neighborhood animals, dogs, and others have peed on recently.
For example, that's a very, very good, very good idea. Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to go off on another subject, but about 10 years ago, I was curious about dumpster diving, and I went on a few dumpster dives with some people that were doing that. And in Manhattan, it's kind of crazy because there's so much really excellent food that is fresh and clean and packaged and put on the streets for lots of strange reasons. But we were in a 2020 piece on television, and they edited in this little dog peeing on a pile of trash. That little dog was not there when we were there. I'll never forget it.
But it made for good television.
Yeah, it sure did.
Yeah.
But we must think about those little dogs and other animals.
Yeah, you must think about those. And you must think about, you know, insecticides and herbicides if you're foraging in a park or a field. And you must think about what belongs to you and what belongs to the neighbor on the other side of the fence. And, you know, always ask permission if you're foraging someplace that's not your land, and don't forage near a busy highway. You know, think they're all common sense things. If you stop and you think about it, they all make sense, these rules.
Right. So that leaves what?
It leaves a lot. It leaves a lot. I mean, the thing about this book that is, to me, so interesting is you really can start in your own backyard, because there's a lot of stuff that I don't know if you have a yard or...
No, living in Queens. I have a terrace.
Okay. All right.
But I can even forage on my terrace.
Yes,
because I've got lamb's quarters that just appears out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. You can. You can forage almost anywhere. You can forage in Central Park. You can forage in Prospect Park. Don't let the rangers catch you. but seriously, a lot of the stuff that's in the park that's forageable are the most invasive exotic plants there. So really, the rangers should be thanking you instead of writing you a ticket when you're pulling out the Japanese knotweed, because it's crowding out a lot of stuff that should be there. But in a lot of parks, they have to post when they spray, so you know not to forage there. And outside of New York City, many national and state parks actually allow you to forage. You can take a certain quantity of berries or nuts per day, as long as you're not doing it for commercial purposes. You can't pull plants up by the roots, but you don't really always want to do that anyway.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking it would be really good if we could learn as children more about this, because certainly we don't want children picking foods that are poisonous, that they shouldn't be eating. But also, like I mentioned before, we've lost all this knowledge, and we really need to get it back.
Yeah.
And I'm not, there's this back in my back, in the back of my mind, if a crisis happens and we don't have any more food in our stores, what are we going to eat? And those who know how to forage are going to have a little bit of an advantage.
We're going to eat each other is what I'm afraid of. But no, you're right.
Soil is
people. My sisters always say that come the apocalypse, they're coming to my house. Because not only do I have a well-stocked pantry, because I do a lot of food preservation, that's kind of my hobby, but also I know what you can eat out there. Now, that doesn't mean I could actually, you know, survive for long if society imploded. But I love driving down the road and thinking, I could eat that, I could eat that, I could eat that.
Now, where did you learn this?
I learned it here. I did not learn it growing up. I'm a gardener by profession. And my wild foods, my foraging mentor is a woman named Leda Meredith, who lives in Brooklyn. And she worked for me as a gardener when I started my company. And we were sitting around having lunch one day, somebody's property, and I had almost nothing in the refrigerator that morning. So I think I had a cheese sandwich, and it was very boring. And she picked a couple of garlic mustard leaves and stuck them in my sandwich, and made all the difference in the world. And it was free, and it was delicious, and I was hooked.
That's crazy. Yeah. It's just amazing. So many different flavors. Some of them, our tongues wouldn't even know what to do with because they'd be so unfamiliar to us.
Yeah, but really good, a lot of them. Really, if it weren't delicious, I would not be interested.
Right. So I'm looking at the ox-eye daisy. Now, I'm a particular fan of leafy green vegetables, and I know that there's a lot out there that I haven't tried. That's page 60.
Yes.
And it's looking rather tasty.
It is. It's one of the... It is very tasty. It is very tasty because it's got a little bit of lemoniness, a little bit of pepperiness to the taste.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's...
It's already seasoned.
It is. It's pre-seasoned salad. And the thing that's nice about it is it's also got some succulence to the leaf. It's a little bit thicker than a lettuce leaf, but it's not super, super thick. So it's got a little... It's got good mouthfeel in addition to sort of some internal spicing.
Now, speaking of all of that, one that I don't like, and I think I saw it here, yes, purslane. Don't like purslane, and it's got that a mouthfeel that I think is very unpleasant.
Are you referring to the mucilaginous quality of purslane? Okay, I will give you that. Purslane is like okra on steroids as far as mucilage.
But it's good for you.
It's really super good for you. And there's a way you can, I mean, I don't know how many millions of ways you've tried it, but if you cook it in a certain way, the way Greeks cook it is sort of saute in olive oil with garlic and then with stewed tomatoes, cook for a long time, and then, of course, they put in some feta cheese because every good Greek puts feta cheese in everything. And it's delicious. And when you cook it long and slow and with the tomato sauce, the stewed tomatoes, the mucilage just
goes away.
Okay. And it's super, super healthy.
All right. I will give purslane
a second chance. Oh, good.
Okay. Another one that I found really fascinating is the ostrich fern on page 56.
Yeah. I love fiddlehead ferns.
I mean, it's very weird looking, strange looking, and yet it's kind of a string bean asparagus. Legacy sort of thing.
Yeah, only it's got a little more density to it. So it's not, I mean, you really bite into it. It's got a little more heft to it as a vegetable. Now, I will say that you have to know the right fern. There are some ferns that are bitter and really unpleasant. And that's why you see that big picture on page 57 there? That shows you what the fern fiddlehead looks like. Other fiddlehead ferns have like really fuzzy coverings and just don't look like this at all. You really want to make sure you get the ostrich fern. That's the most delicious one.
Well, I'm not going to have them unless you're with me and you can pick.
Okay. All right. It's a good way to start. But, you know, you're joking, but that's how you start.
Yeah. I would never discover something and say, oh, that looks like page 69 in Ellen's
Except
book.
Purslane, you already know. So you could do that yourself.
Well, I discovered purslane when I belong to a community-supported agriculture group, which I don't at the moment, and I encourage people to do that.
I do, yeah.
It may or may not fit your lifestyle because you have to pick up the produce box every week at a certain time, and if you're not going to be around for a month or two, it's not as good as a deal, but you do, depending on the farmer, you might get to learn about new foods, and that's what's exciting about it. Some people may find it annoying, but when you're getting a surprise every week in a box, that's really fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, another thing that surprised me was the spruce. I didn't know you could eat that.
Yeah. And it's not just that you can eat it. It's fantastic.
I didn't know that.
It's fantastic. And it can be either sweet or savory.
I mean, how would you eat it? It doesn't... Who ever thought of biting into that?
Well, you don't... Yeah, see, I don't know. I don't know who thought of it the first time. I wish I could say, Karen, that was my idea. I was the one who thought of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't. The spruce... The thing that I made this year that I loved most was a spruce tip shortbread cookie.
Okay.
And it just you just grind it up in the food processor with whatever sweetener you're using, if it's a sugar or a brown sugar, or you would just chop it up really small if you were going to do it with a, you know, an agave nectar or something else. But for a shortbread, you use real sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's delicious that way, but it's also great in savory dishes. You can do it in food processor with salt and then use that salt on roasted root vegetables.
Mm.
And you think, well, how's that going to taste? It actually has kind of almost a citrusy taste to it when it's cooked, which is not what you'd expect, but it's delicious.
I guess I'm thinking about rosemary, which is a kind of a...
It's not dissimilar.
Tippy, spiny sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that I'm going to have to find or try somewhere.
In the spring.
But look-alike to avoid are the use.
Yeah.
Use are bad.
Use are poison.
Use, that's Y-E-W-S. It doesn't matter how
not
you spell
guys.
It.
Yeah.
You just want to not eat it.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the scary part of this.
Well, that's why you never eat anything you're not 100% sure of. That is really the first rule. We said the first rule was dog pee, but it's not. The first rule is never eat anything you're not 100%
positive
of.
Dog pee may not be actually that bad.
It's probably not as bad for you as you is.
Now, we know... those who listen to my show and myself, people who love healthy food, that berries are really important and probably the best fruits out there. And you talk about a number of them here, and I think most of them that when you describe them tend to be tart.
Yes, most of them are tart.
And that's the secret, because we've hybridized so many fruits and so many berries to be less tart and sweet for our unsophisticated palates. And the tarter ones are probably the healthier ones.
I don't know why that is, though. Do you? You probably know more about that chemistry than I do. I know how the tartness is useful to me as a cook because it's an indication of greater amounts of pectin often.
Mm.
And also, you know, some of the plant chemicals that evolve to sort of keep animals from eating. Although with berries, you want the animals to eat so they can then, shall we say, disperse
the
seed.
They poop the seeds.
Well, I was going for, you know, the word disperse, but go ahead, say poop if that's that makes you happy.
I like the word poop.
Okay.
Okay.
But yes, they are mostly very tart fruits, you know, which are delicious. Delicious, if you know
right.
how to do with them.
I'm looking at the Juneberry.
Which is actually not that tart. It's just straight off the tree. You can eat that and be very, very happy.
Juniper?
Yeah.
And we can eat... For some reason, I thought juniper was not to be eaten.
No. First of all, I don't know what your views on alcohol are.
Occasionally.
But gin is flavored with juniper.
Juniper. Oh,
and sauerkraut is flavored with juniper.
That's right.
So,
but that's where I read it. You can't have too many of them, I read.
I would love to...
I
know that because
I have too many of them. Yeah.
I don't know. I use it in a dry rub.
Mm-hmm.
They're very strong tasting, so you don't need a lot of them. You could use 6 or 7 berries to flavor an entire quart of sauerkraut. You really don't need a lot.
Right.
But you know, this is something that you can now buy at Sahadi or in a good spice store is the juniper berries. And I love to crush up a few and mix them with other things as a dry rub.
Okay. Now, what about flowers.
Mm.
Eating flowers.
Occasionally
I eat at this one Thai restaurant and they always have this...
Dendrobium orchid on the plate?
Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't eat those if I were you. Not because the dendrobium orchid isn't safe, but because you don't know what's been sprayed on the dendrobium orchid while it was growing. If it, you know, they are edible. And if you were growing it and not spraying anything on it, but do you know if the Thai restaurant is going down to the florist on the... I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know that.
But in general, flowers, to me, are not the most interesting things to eat just because they're so ephemeral. They're so... You know, they don't really feed me. I'm an enthusiastic eater. I like a little more substance.
Right.
But there
I wouldn't make a main course out of it, but it's they have some really lovely, delicate flavors.
And there are some that I'm quite fond of, like yucca flowers, which are in bloom right now, have a great, crisp, cool taste to them. And if you're like on the West Coast, pineapple guava flowers have almost a cinnamony taste to them. And those are two that I really do like.
Oregon grape looks beautiful.
Yeah. And that's one that'll pucker you right up.
oh, Oh, gosh, these are all so, so beautiful. Okay, now we're here in New York City. Mm-hmm. So what's going on in Central Park?
Well, first I have to say it's against the rules.
To forage.
To forage.
Yeah,
in Central
I remember
Park.
Wild Man Steve yeah. Brill talking about his excursions and arrests mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. being ultimately allowed to give tours.
Yeah. It is technically against the rules to forage in Central Park. Although I think if you were, you know, picking up stuff on the ground, if they were nuts, like every fall, let's say from mid September up until Thanksgiving, under every female ginkgo tree, you will see crowds of mostly Asian women, but I'm there too, picking nuts up off the ground. And nobody's going to stop you from mm-hmm. from doing that because they're just lying there on the ground. But technically, you are not supposed to pick anything in Central Park. So when I or anybody else lead a foraging tour in the park, we are mostly just saying, see this? If you find it someplace else, you can pick it and eat it, and this is what you can do with it. And I think... Honestly, I think that's mostly for liability reasons. I don't think the city wants to be sued by somebody who picks a plant and, you know, then gets sick because they weren't paying attention. And they
too many lawyers in New York.
It's a litigious society, and that doesn't always help us.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about animal law in the next section, so in the next part of this show. And it has its advantages, but okay, we'll just move on. Mushrooms.
Yeah.
Now, mushrooms, I'm a big mushroom lover, and we're learning more and more about how nutritious mushrooms are. Sometimes I call them natural chemotherapy because of their phenomenal anti-cancer fighting properties.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could be deadly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I only put five mushrooms in here. And the five I chose are mushrooms that have no poisonous lookalikes.
Good.
And
okay.
I thought that was very important for people who were just starting out. Now, I'm very fortunate in that, like, one of the best mushroom people in the entire world, Gary Linkoff, is a colleague of mine up at the Botanical Garden. Mm-hmm. So I started out studying with him, and he's also a big forager. So it's great if you can learn from someone, because there's nothing like touching the actual mushroom.
Right. Somebody who's been doing it a long time and is alive.
And is still alive. It's a good sign. But the five that are in here are absolutely foolproof. There's if you find something that looks like one of these pictures, you are not going to die. Unless you have an allergic reaction, but you could have an allergic reaction to a peanut or a strawberry. So.
Right. Wow. Oyster mushrooms.
Yeah. Nothing looks like an oyster mushroom. If you really read the description, if you look at how the oyster mushroom comes out of the wood, it always grows on wood.
Mm.
And, you know, but you have to really read the descriptions. You have to, it's not just, you know, you can't just say, oh, look, that's white. Maybe it's an oyster mushroom. You have to really turn it over and look at it and take a spore print and see how it attaches to the wood.
Okay.
If that sounds like too much work, just go to the store and buy your mushrooms.
Well, I would love to do this, you know, just like anybody. I don't know where I'm going to find the time.
Well, that's the great thing about, you know, if you're walking to work, if you're walking through the park, you might see four or five things just on your way into work that you could eat.
Yeah, I always see dandelions.
Yeah.
And I often see lamb's quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, that somehow it just grows in my pots on my terrace.
Yeah, well, it seeds itself so readily. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a lot of others out there. And my understanding of dandelion was the Europeans brought it over because they liked to eat it. And then it became a weed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we don't know any better.
Because we are too stupid to try it. But it's delicious. And you can eat the leaves, and you can eat the flowers, and you can eat the roots. So it's really a superstar as far as I'm concerned.
And good for us. Okay,
yeah.
So now what do you do with all these things? You've got some nice little tips at the end of the book
mm-hmm.
on preserving advice.
Yeah, because, you know, when something... You always want to eat something when it's at its peak, and usually that means you get a lot of it all at once, and what are you going to do with it? Like right now, blueberries, gallons every weekend I'm picking.
Where?
Out in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's, you know, so what are you going to do? You can't... You can have blueberry pancakes, and you can just eat them fresh, but you have to preserve them. So
right.
You learn how to freeze and can and dry and do all these things so that you can enjoy the harvest throughout the year.
Mm. Well, one thing I discovered not too long ago was making a jam or a jelly, just something really simple from dried fruit, and it's a no-brainer. I take the dried fruit, like a dried apricot, for example, or anything dried. I add some water to it. I cook it until it's soft. I puree it, and I put it in jars. And there's nothing. That's it.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining this would be terrific.
You could do the same thing.
Dehydrated, and then when I was ready, I could make some jam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I could just make jam right off the bat.
Well, you could do that, too. You could do that, too. Well, and the nice thing about jam is you don't have to use artificial pectin because you just keep cooking it until it thickens to be where you want it to be.
Right. Now, I've made some raw pies from time to time, and I've used blueberries. Mm-hmm. Because when I blend a blueberry, it naturally firms up because of the pectin in it. But that doesn't happen with strawberries or raspberries. So no. Are there other berries that have that much pectin in them?
Yes, there are. It's fruit very widely, but currants and gooseberries are very high in pectin. Raspberries, blackberries, not so much. Cherries, if they're sour cherries, very high in pectin. Strawberries, not so much. Apples, very high in pectin. Pears, not so much. Apricots and peaches, not so much. Plums have quite a lot. So it really depends on the fruit.
Right. I mean, have you ever done that where you pureed blueberries and put it in the refrigerator? I mean, it just turned into jello, blueberry jello.
It kind of looks like like this. There was this old Monty Python sketch, the blancmange. I don't know. It was this giant pudding that like won at Wimbledon and ate people. It's like the blueberries congeal to form this solid. It's almost beautiful. It's got this jewel tone color to it and this sheen and yeah. Yeah, I actually do that on an open tart with some goat cheese and then put the blueberries. Was that for the goat cheese?
Yeah. Okay. That's okay.
I like goat cheese.
Just a disclaimer here, I do not promote goat cheese consumption.
Understood. Okay.
But that's okay. We're all friends here in the plant foraging world. And you give tours?
I do.
Tell me about those.
I never pick anything illegally in a city park, but I do take people on walks through Central Park, mostly in Central Park, sometimes at the New York Botanical Garden as well. They're foraging walks to educate people, to show people what is out there that they might be able to eat. And people will say, I've got that all over my yard. I never knew I could eat that. And,
right.
And you know, hopefully they go home and then actually do something about it.
Speaking of which, bamboo. Can we just have a bamboo moment? My brother's got, an infestation of bamboo in his backyard, and I'm thinking dinner, lunch, breakfast, over and over.
In the spring, though. See, that's the thing. It's in the right season. If you went out there now, bamboo would be not delicious. But if you go out in the spring when the shoots are just 6 to 8 inches tall, that's when you cut them
down. Tender bamboo shoots.
Yeah. And very, very easy to prepare. You just need boiling water.
Wow. Oh, okay. Now, did you ever have a bad experience foraging?
You mean like a puking my guts out experience?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it with?
Evening primrose root. Which many people eat with no trouble whatsoever. I have no food allergies that I know of. Maybe I have to try it again, and I will try it again, despite the fact that I really did puke my guts out. But I'll try it again because I want to know if it was an aberration or if it just really doesn't agree with me.
It could have been something.
Or maybe I prepared it wrong, although I highly doubt that, but it's possible.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it happened, so there's... I like to think that when we have a very vital body, if something goes in that the body doesn't like, it will get rid of it immediately.
Yes.
And that's important.
I think it is.
And a lot of people, their bodies are not vital because their bodies have given up because they keep filling it up with processed food and too much animal food and a lot of junk, and the body gives up. But I will confess that there are times when I do... is there a technical term for vomiting? I don't know.
Puking your guts out. That's the technical. I'm sorry. That is the technical term.
But it happens from time to time, and I never know what it is. All I know is I thank my body for knowing.
To get rid
I
of
don't
that.
Know.
Yeah.
And it's over, just like that. Mm-hmm. And that's a vital body.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, let's not end on that note. Let's.
Can I? I don't know if I'm.
Yes.
I'm speaking at the New York Public Library next Tuesday.
Ooh, where is which one?
At the Mid Manhattan branch at 6:30, and it's free. So if anybody,
free is good.
Yes, free is good. And I'll be serving foraged cookies at the end. So if anybody,
cookies.
Yeah.
Very good. And you'll have some books there, maybe?
I will have books, and I'll be showing pictures of a lot of these plants, so maybe people will be able to say, I grow that. I didn't know I could eat it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I highly recommend that, and I think it should be fun. How long does it last?
It's an hour, 6:30 to 7:30, and then I'll stick around and take questions,
okay,
of course.
Great. Well, Ellen, thank you very much for joining me here. This has been fun, and I'm just going to go start, well, maybe soon, foraging.
Do it.
Very soon. I'm going to step outside beyond my terrace.
Okay.
Okay. So we're going to take a quick break now. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Stay with me, and we will be right back with Paul Waldow talking about animal studies. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on July 30th, 2013. Okay. That was good. I really enjoyed that last conversation about foraging. Well, now we're going to move on to something that is also very important, and that is animal studies and animal rights. I'm going to bring on my next guest, Paul Waldow. He's an educator, scholar, and activist working at the intersection of animal studies, law, ethics, religion, and cultural studies. He is an associate professor at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, where he's the senior faculty for the Master of Science graduate program in anthrozoology. Paul has also taught at Harvard Law School since 2002, and in 2014 will again serve as the Barker Visiting Associate Professor on Animal Law. Welcome to It's All About Food, Paul.
Hi, Karen. Nice to be here.
Hi. You know, I've listened to a number of your interviews, and I've been reading your books, and I'm just kind of in awe at this very peaceful and non-judgmental tone that you have.
What a nice compliment. Thank you. And can I reciprocate? I'm preparing and I'm thinking. I get to talk to Karen. We're going to talk about responsible eating issues. And I think, gosh, that's such an immediate day-to-day issue that helps condition all of us to be more responsible actors in so many other realms. So it's really an enjoyable thing to talk about this subject because there's so many creative and responsible ways to address this.
Yeah, well, I always try and find different ways because I know different people are going to respond to one thing or another. Some people appeal to a religious spin. Some people appeal to a health spin or environmental. And there's what got me on this path was not wanting to kill animals.
And also, I think in education, you find the same thing. If you're a good educator, you're so sensitive to the fact that the students in front of you arrive and they want to share, but they often arrive with very personal and distinctive paths. So part of the task of an educator in this area, Karen, is listening to them to say, how do I take this person's talent and let them flourish as much as possible?
Well, that is indeed a skill, a great skill to have. Okay, so let's jump into this. I've been talking about animal rights a bit on this program, and I'm going to continue for the next few weeks. One of the things that I was thinking about is that we seem to be, I like to visualize things, and I think of a timeline or a line of where the human consciousness is on this subject. And we were talking last week about those that are way, way out there on what some people call the extreme and saying that that the only type of activism is the all or nothing approach where we tell people it has to be one way and nothing else. And then there are those that are in the middle that allow for small steps, and I think and how important all of that is in order to move the general feeling to a better place.
I think you're right that it takes a lot of different attitudes to constitute a social movement and a lot of different approaches. Some circumstances do require us to be to go to the root, which is the meaning of the word radical. I don't think violence is ever justified. I think that's by far the most important position because so much of what animal protection people do is about stopping violence. It's pretty hard to use, the tool you're protesting against in as part of that protest. Now, everybody knows there are complex situations like self-defense where some kind of force is needed. But I think on the whole, the really important principle is to avoid violence because that's the problem. It is no simple task, of course, because the people who are in have the privileges or the businesses that want to make profits in tough ways aren't going to give up those privileges. And so how do you move them? We need a lot of different approaches to try to convince them change is important for all of us.
I was going to bring this up later, but I'm going to bring it up now. And that is that there are a small amount of people that believe that violence is necessary, and a few of them, unfortunately, in somewhat violent act, had precipitated some laws that came out that make it even more difficult for us to protest today, or at least to uncover things that are going on in factory farms.
Yeah, the recent decision just in the last couple of days on ag gag laws has been pretty good, where people recognize how incredibly unfair. Not only do they harm the non-human animals, but they harm the right of us to speak freely about what's actually happening in the world. Industry is powerful. They can lobby to get very narrow-minded and favoritism-oriented laws like that. But last year, there were important ag gag laws that passed. Now we have to undo those. But this is the struggle that every social movement goes through. It's a sort of pendulum swinging back and forth. And the hopeful thing is that people stay the course. And that's, I think, to go back to the responsible eating, that really is the day-to-day encounter we have with so much of the world around us, environmentally, animal protection-wise. And that's just something, if people start there, they start to see how important it is to get to the other areas as well.
You mentioned this a lot in your book in one way or another, but responsible eating, sure, is important, but many people think they're responsible. Many people think they're compassionate, and yet they don't have a clue. They're either not educated or they're so close-minded that they don't even acknowledge everything that's around them. And you talk a lot about what the animal perceives. And we have no clue what other animals perceive. You know, we barely can understand what our partners and our parents and our children are thinking, let alone other species.
Yeah, that's a really important note. In the most recent book, the Animal Studies book, puts right up front that the task has to be for us to humbly seek out other animals' realities, their communal realities, their individual realities, but also to admit, listen, this is a limited, we're only going to have limited success here. We have big brains and we're wonderful when we're humble, but often on this area we've not been. So seeking that out is important. I'm sure that the way for us to go through this is through education. But so much of our education has really dumbed people down. There's a very famous saying by a man named Helvetius that said people are not born stupid, they're born ignorant. They're made stupid by education. Now, of course, he was talking about a bad kind of education. Our job is, it's up to us, can we turn our education system to help us with our limits and humility versus making us arrogant and even unaware of the world?
There's one thing you mentioned at some point, I think it's in Animal Studies, The People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn's great book. And that's just one book that I think should be in all high school students' history classes. I learned so much about it, and not just what was in the book, but just it's such a great example of how we are taught to see things a certain way.
And not only was Howard Zinn a great man, but he did us all a great service of showing how the history that we learned was this rather one-dimensional, very narrow-minded kind of history. And if the history had treated other humans so badly, Karen, and it really has, it continues. We continue to do this, of course, today, but he helped us all see it much better. He modeled for us that you can be honest about history, even its ugly parts, in a constructive way to say, come on, let's see this and let's try to stop this. And that's very pertinent to what we do to the other living beings besides our own species members. And I often, when I write, am quite interested in the point that, listen, if somebody's really for animal protection, for animal rights, since humans are primates and mammals and thus animals, animal rights is a position that just says these important complex beings deserve protections, and humans slot in there, and of course many others do as well in the animal protection movement. So this is, for me, a win-win situation, but most of us know it's often a polarized debate. People pretend that animal protection people don't like humans. Almost everyone I know who's an animal protectionist really sees the value of protecting humans just as fully.
Well, when you understand what's behind animal rights and understanding that exploitation is wrong, that causing pain and suffering is wrong, it's wrong for humans and it's wrong for other non-human species. We understand that.
And there's a wonderful set of arguments to be made about, listen, of course it's better for the non-human animals if we realize what you just said, but it's also amazingly good for us.
Mm-hmm.
We develop our own moral character and strength and muscles. What happens when we ignore that is our moral muscles, as it were, atrophy, and you lose the ability to be sensitive, not only, of course, to non-humans, but to humans as well. And just be taking responsibility in day-to-day actions. And reading is, I actually think humans are remarkable animals, remarkable beings, but only when we're humble. When we're out there being really arrogant about how important we are and the world was designed for us, we're rather ordinary and ugly, to be frank. So to me, there's a win-win situation here for living in a much better world.
There are other social movements that are moving forward and probably not in the places where they ideally want to be. Civil rights, women's rights, sexual rights, racial rights, et cetera, et cetera. But the difference with animal rights is that these non-human species don't have a voice.
Yeah, there's a powerful Australian group called Voiceless, which is precisely looking at that point. For me, the harms we've done to women, disfavored races, all sorts of marginalized human groups, children, for heaven's sake, as well. When we become sensitive to them, it just enlarges our capacity. One of the interesting things about compassion is it's not really a hyper-finite capacity. The more compassionate you are, you recognize how you can pay that forward. And being caring across the species line and protecting local dogs, local cats, wildlife locally, that really tunes you up to how important compassion is. And that easily comes back inside the species line repeatedly. So for me, in our classes, we're constantly affirming that, listen, animal protection is about protecting all of the living beings on Earth as much as we are able to do. And that always will benefit humans because we're surely among the most complicated animals, even if we're not obviously the single one that matters. But we definitely matter, and so animal protection has a good message for humans as well.
Well, it's very exciting that there are more and more animal studies courses at the university level. I remember when I was going to school back in the 70s, I don't remember. I remember, you know, there were a handful of women's studies classes, but I don't remember any animal studies. And how has that changed over the decades?
Well, these days there are literally hundreds and hundreds of animal studies classes, individual classes. You can go to the Animals and Society Institute and see them listed. It's really impressive. But what we've done in the last 5 years or so is move to the level of creating whole programs where people can not just have a single course, and those single courses are really important. But if they're important, imagine what happens when somebody over a sustained period of time with others who are doing this as well gets a chance to encounter these issues, to nurture their own understanding and others. And it's that we all as a community work so much better than we do as individuals if we're really doing this with goodwill. Those programs have started to emerge. And the Kinesis program has got wonderful dynamics. So do some of the animal law classes in places. I mean, the one at Harvard is such a pleasure to teach because the students are so involved for all the right reasons. Nobody takes that class because they're trying to make more money. They take that class because they care. And when you're in a class, Karen, and people care like that, which happens in the graduate program and in the animal law classes, it's really, well, sometimes your job as the instructor is sort of to just nurture them and get out of their way because they're so talented. You just want to see where will they take it. But it's fun education when it's working really well.
You write early on in your new animal studies book, I'm going to read here, that this introduction to animal studies, it touches so many different fields: history, cultural studies, education, natural and social sciences of many kinds, political studies, law, philosophy, critical studies, literature, arts, comparative religion, ethics, sociology, public policy studies, social psychology, geography, anthropology, archaeology, criminology. It's amazing.
Well, you know, it's humbling to hear that list because I'm obviously not an expert in every one of those. I was certainly writing about each one of those. For me, the whole task was something wonderfully interesting is happening in all those fields on the animal question. And how is it that we could coordinate them and cross-fertilize? So to let geographers who've done wonderful work talk to sociologists, talk to the law people, talk to the religion people, talk to the philosophers, et cetera. But that often doesn't happen in the modern university, and we need that multifaceted, interdisciplinary approach. That sounds awfully intellectual, but it's so common sense that literature and art have something to say. So how do we get these different disciplines to talk to each other? If we do, I think we'll see how really ancient and deep this concern is, and how, if we do it again, Karen, our educational system can really be much more remarkable than it is right now.
Well, when I think about exploitation, and when I think about what we do to animals, it's so disheartening on so many levels. But then I think there are so many species that have so many skills and so many talents that we really take for granted. And if we really respected them for what they knew and what they knew how to do, we would be so far ahead in so many fields.
Yeah, what a wonderful world it would be if we'd all been educated. I was just reading someone in preparation for this who talks about how important it is for us to educate children. But frankly, we often educate children that to be an adult, you have to put away those childish things like caring about animals.
Mm-hmm.
Really? I don't think that's right. You find great figures like historically the Buddha, for example. You find wonderfully Albert Schweitzer, contemporary people like Jane Goodall, really stunningly interesting people, have at the center of their lives these deep concerns about other living beings. And it is the way I think of an integrated person in terms of, again, you could talk your table choices, your other consumer choices, your treatment of the local wildlife, just your awareness in general of how history shows us how many people cared about this issue. It's a question of being gentle. One of my favorite quotes is this one from Thich Nhat Hanh. He's talking about the question of, is there a path to peace? And he says, there's no path to peace. Peace is the path.
Mm-hmm.
And you
right.
think, yes, in a way, this sort of nonviolence in the world, not crazy nonviolence. I mean, you get to do self-defense in certain situations without question. But this very caring, deep-seated commitment to nonviolence is a really important aspect, how would you say, an important possibility for us.
I'm really curious about the students that take your classes and what disciplines are they studying and what makes them interested in taking your course. I mean, I imagine some of them might want to be lawyers, but there must be other fields.
There are some who want to be teachers at the elementary level or the secondary school level or in the university and get PhDs, and some want to go on. One of our students in the corporate program is going on to Oxford. Others will go be lawyers. But frankly, many of them will start nonprofits. Some of them will start profit businesses where they want to use the best aspects of doing modern business in an ethical way to try to help out with the problem. For example, you can see someone providing ethically sourced fast food. If they could do that profitably, what a wonderful contribution that would be. Many of them want to do sanctuaries to provide protection for the different kinds of animals. I think to answer the question, what do? They do everything. And part of my job as the principal recruiter is to just find out where this person is. It's almost always a female. In the entering class of 20, there are 18 females. That's pretty standard these days in animal studies courses, unfortunately. I think we're better off if it's a bit more balanced, but frankly, the way it's going is so good, I don't want to complain. But I think we'll be better off when we come back to a little bit better gender balance. But what do? They do everything. Some of them are literature. Some of them simply have been, they're 40 and 50 years old and simply want finally have a form of education that they care the most about, and they'll do this with abandon. And that's what makes it, Karen, such a good educational dynamic. Inside the class, these are talented, accomplished people helping educate each other. So sometimes, as I said earlier, my job is to sort of just step aside, get out of their way, help nurture them, but to really see that the community is the real genius here.
As you mentioned before, humans have done some pretty awful things. We continue to do awful things to each other and to animals. I think probably the worst thing we've come up with is the confinement of animals, CAFOs, the factory farming of animals for food.
Yeah.
I just have to pause when I just think about it. I can't really think about it too much because it's so overwhelming.
Because the numbers are so mind-numbing that you lose what's happening. So that people begin to say things like, I don't want to know. But of course, implicit in that is they do know.
Yeah, we all know.
We all need to make those kinds of choices that stop that sort of immorality.
So you talked about veterinarians and some of them who work with these factory farms treating animals that are going to be slaughtered at some point and are living in excrement and filth and are diseased. And there was one story about one who, well, maybe he wasn't a veterinarian, but he came up with a solution to cure some of the pigs.
Yeah.
And
the Animal Rights book, the 2011 book, and somebody who worked in a big factory farm and healed the animal, the pigs, on his own because he came from a ranch where that's what they would have done. And he was disciplined. But he bought the medicine himself. He was disciplined, but eventually got his job back, but told never to do that again.
Yeah, he was reprimanded. But what I wondered is, I thought that veterinarians, for the most part, got into the field because they cared about animals.
Yes. Well, at Tufts Vet School, which I worked at for a decade, I educated over 1,000 veterinary students in ethics. I think it's clear 90-plus percent do come for that reason. Now, they don't always go out the door with that because, interestingly, individual vets and many of the entering veterinary students are beautifully committed to healing. But the actual veterinary profession, through its big professional organization in the United States, through its administrators in the schools, can be very focused on grants, which come from the federal government often, or big businesses. And so they are not driven by the same kind of motivation that would lead someone to go to vet school saying, I want to help heal. Okay. And so those two values coexist in vet schools. And it's a tough place for somebody who is uncomfortable with big scientific grants that do a lot of harm. And so a veterinary medicine is a very complicated world, but individual vets, almost everyone I've ever met has, if you tap, now they're mostly women are vets these days, if you touch them in a good way, you can see their heart clearly wants to be in a good place, often is. Many of them are profoundly good healers. And the question is, how do we get those vets in charge of big national veterinary medicine? That's a big challenge.
Yeah, well, we've certainly the news often centers on sensational stories, and I've read a number of them with veterinarians that will drug race horses in order to get them to perform better, even if they have a lot of inflammation and don't really treat them appropriately because it's all about the money.
Yeah, this is an issue, and it's an issue that this profession, which is a big part of how our society addresses non-human animals, goes forward. And veterinary medicine, I have great hopes for, but it was complicated working there for 10 years because of the powerful forces not being very interested in the ethics side, just in the financial and scientific breakthrough side. Okay, scientific breakthroughs are important, but not at any cost. We don't experiment on humans to get scientific breakthroughs. Well, we do a little bit, sadly, but we roundly repudiate that generally, and the question is, when will we move to a position of protecting more kinds of living beings from this sort of thing and moving to other kinds of science, which are difficult to do, but you can do them, where you can produce scientific results without having to harm these living beings in such tough ways?
I look forward to that, and I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime, but it's something to hope for. So we just have 2 minutes left. Do you have an animal story that where you were touched by an animal?
Well, I could tell so many of these, but I grew up in Southern California, and I grew up in an area where there were dolphins, but I talked to a local scientist, and he said, we don't know much about them. My brothers and I learned to watch them from the cliffs in Huntington Beach, and then we learned to swim with them, and eventually I learned to kayak with them. But once when one came up to me when I was in the water, I'd swim out, and I could see them coming down the coast, and it came up to me and looked at me, and I had such a sense of, oh, my, there's a light on. The animal was right next to me, and then it darted away. It got away. But that experience to me was what somebody called an epiphany, where I realized there are other beings that are just as at home, just as much I have a light on as we do. Mm-hmm. It's tough to encounter them, and I was in that being space. But I was forever thankful for that individual dolphin coming up and interacting with me in that way.
Yes, very, very special. If we would only open our eyes to see everything that is out there.
Yes.
Well, Paul, thank you for joining me. Thank you for all the great books that you've been writing and all of the people you've been educating. That is tremendous work. Thank you so much.
And Karen, thank you for the opportunity here and also for the program. It's really a major contribution. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you. And you're listening to It's All About Food. That was Paul Waldow. And you may look for his books, Animal Studies, Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know. Very good reading. And please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit. And either at that site or the swinggourmets.com site, you can visit and watch the new video, The Making of the Swing Gourmets, The Real American Barbecue. It's 28 minutes, so find a comfortable place and take the time to watch it. I think you'll enjoy it. Please let me know by sending me an email at info@realmeals.org. And have a delicious week.